We also studied all possible correlative material on such subjects as levitation, teleportation and similar phenomena in an effort to throw some light on how spaceships could operate without fuel. We also wanted to meet and talk personally with the other witnesses to Mr. Adamski's contact. Before our pilgrimage was concluded, we were fortunate enough to contact 4 out of 6 of these witnesses. But above all, we wanted to meet as many other people as possible who were having definite saucer experiences. We wanted as broad a view of this amazing subject as we could obtain. By this time we both felt that we must learn the truth, because if the Earth was really being contacted by extraterrestrial beings in large numbers at this time, it was the most significant development in the world today. We soon realized that the type of people who were evidencing interest in saucers included some rather distinctive categories. There were those who had a serious astronomical interest, those who had a definite technical or engineering interest, and those who had a decided philosophical or metaphysical interest. Then there were the science fiction enthusiasts. These latter were of little interest to us, except for one amazing point, namely that reality itself seemed to be only a few steps behind their advanced imaginative efforts. That fact has never ceased to be a cause of wonderment to us. Last but not least, the worthy inevitable curiosity seekers and a sort of fringe of fanatics. These latter certainly furnished a sort of comic relief for the more serious research which we and others were trying to do. Some of these enthusiasts even routed us out of bed in the middle of the night to tell us excitedly that if we would look out of the window in a certain direction, we would certainly see a spaceship, or even a flock of them. Maybe our eyesight was a bit weak, but we were never able to discern spaceships in the night sky, and we found this type of assistance a bit annoying. More and more the need of caution and care was impressed upon us if we were ever to prove to our own satisfaction the truth or falsity and also the nature of these sky visitors. We realized that many of the experiences being reported by sorcerers were without witnesses. In these cases we hoped to meet the individuals personally so that we could at least judge for ourselves, if not for others. We also decided to use the method of coordinating the experiences and observations of various sorcerers to see if we could detect or piece together a reasonable pattern of information or knowledge. A new book, Aboard a Flying Saucer by Truman Bethurum, was released, and arrangements were made to have Mr. Bethurum come to Detroit. We had read his book and were looking forward eagerly to meeting the author and hearing his lecture. We enjoyed his talk immensely, but as always we were more interested in the man behind the book, the man behind the lecture, the personality having the experience. In this respect we were quite fortunate, because during their stay in Detroit Mr. and Mrs. Bethurum came to our home to visit us. We became so enthralled in his experiences that we talked until the wee small hours of the morning. Mr. Bethurum is a large, tall, and husky out-of-doors type of man. His schooling has been limited to grammar school and a few years in high school, but he nevertheless speaks with an excellent choice of words. In his work he is an expert maintenance mechanic, familiar with dredges and road building equipment, and is highly respected by his fellow workers. We liked his simple, sincere and forthright nature. We tried to put ourselves in his place as he related in private the highlights of his amazing encounters with space people and answered our questions in the relaxed and unrestrained atmosphere of our home. We found that it means much to get away from the tense, formal and sometimes hostile atmosphere of a public lecture where sorcerers have to be on guard or on the defensive every moment. We feel that our best understanding of the entire subject has come about from these relaxed meetings with sorcerers whom we were fortunate enough to meet. We cannot, of course, directly verify Mr. Bethurum's experiences because we were not present. All we can do is to convey to you our own impressions of the man and his experiences as we discussed them with him in our home. For those who are not familiar with his experiences, may we briefly recount that on a July night in 1952 he first contacted a large round flat flying saucer in a desolate area near Glendale, Nevada, USA. The crew led him to the captain, who turned out to be feminine instead of masculine. Footnote. He had the experience of actually boarding the spaceship and conversing with the captain in English. He later learned that she could speak and write several of our Earth languages. Between July and November of 1952, Mr. Bethurum made 11 contacts and boarded the same. This space being gave her name as Aura Rains. The authors have felt that this might well be a symbolic name conveying the cosmic concept that the Aura reigns. Deep students of cosmic truth recognize that control of the Aura is one of the cosmic steps in man's regaining his lost control of himself and of matter. 21. Kraft on as many occasions. However, he was not given a ride on the saucer. He went aboard it on the ground. Many details are set forth in his written account, and to us these details are worthy of intense study by any sincere researcher. Taken alone, these details might appear to be too fantastic to merit serious attention, but in terms of the coordinating work of our research, they are, in our opinion, of outstanding value as a contribution to our human knowledge of this vast subject. The details are not out of line with the larger picture of spacecraft, space people and space phenomena which gradually unfolded to our astonished eyes as our saucer pilgrimage proceeded. We were favorably and very deeply impressed with Mr. Bethurum's unimaginative sincerity. It is no secret and certainly no unfavorable reflection on him that he felt he needed help in writing his book. The ghostwriter played up the cosmic romance angle of his experience and used words and phrases of a nature which he himself might never have employed. Knowing the man as we do, may we state that even after the greater perspective of our pilgrimage, we still regard his experiences as some of the greatest contributions in the entire saucer saga. In our humble opinion, he had not only one of the greatest personal saucer experiences, but he had one of the hardest rows to hoe, because not a single friend had the courage to be a witness to the contacts. Moreover, his naturalness and simple honesty resulted in an account of his experiences uncontaminated by speculative science or philosophical propaganda. It was, in short, a priceless factual account. We often wonder whether if some of us ordinary mortals had those experiences, we could have told about them as factually and sincerely as he did. We have learned that spacer visitors are quite choosy as regards the characteristics of those who are physically contacted. And in our thinking, Truman Bethurum had certain qualities which made him acceptable for these contacts. Moreover, without any pre-knowledge on his part of their peculiar mastery which space beings are able to exercise over energy or matter, he told us the incident covering the instantaneous disappearance of his flashlight and the experience of his seeing his spacer friends leave a restaurant while a companion whom he had posted outside did not see them come out. Serious students of this subject will understand the deeper implications of these two incidents. However, Mr. Bethurum said he did not know how these things happened, they just happened. Regarding the inability of our astronomers to locate a planet called Clarion behind the moon from which the saucer came, we discussed this point with Mr. Bethurum in detail. From our discussion and questioning, we gathered that the spaceship captain did not intend to convey the idea that the saucer came from a planet in our own solar system behind the moon, but that it came from a planet in another more distant solar system, and the phrase behind the moon was a general designation used for distant outer space. We have kept in contact with this pioneer sorcerer by correspondence and know of his subsequent efforts to again contact this spaceship. We know that a spaceship has since flown over him twice but has not landed. In these, his latest efforts, we sincerely wish him well. More recently, the authors have received word from Truman Bethurum stating that he is in Prescott, Arizona, that his contact with extraterrestrial beings is continuing, and that under their guidance he is endeavoring to establish a New Age sanctuary of thought, a group dedicated to world peace. Chapter 4. Dr. George Hunt Williamson. In June of 1954, our saucer horizon was happily enlarged by our becoming acquainted with Dr. George Hunt Williamson. He was being sponsored in a Detroit lecture by a close friend of ours. We looked forward to knowing him because of his radio contact with space beings and because he was one of the eyewitnesses to the Adamski contact. In addition, He made the plaster casts of the footprints of the spacer visitor on that memorable occasion. We were very desirous of getting acquainted with those sorcerers who were having actual sorcerer experiences and contacts of one form or another. We wanted to get the stories behind the books they had written, to get the real feel of their experiences so we could judge for ourselves. Also, we hoped to get additional information which possibly was considered too advanced to be published at the time the books were written. May we state that we found more than meets the eye in most cases. Remember, we are dealing with a subject which is literally out of this world, or at least out in front of practically all branches of human knowledge. There are no convenient precedents to go by, and no help in forthcoming from accepted authorities. Anyone who really wants to learn about our sky visitors will find he has embarked upon a lonely and uncharted path. Possibly this is part of the fascination of such a research. It is real pioneer work every step of the way. Before meeting this sorcerer personally, we found out a few interesting facts about his background. He was born in 1926, which made him less than 30 years of age. His home is in Prescott, Arizona. He is married and has a small son. Despite his youth, he is a doctor of anthropology and had distinguished himself sufficiently in this field to be listed in Who's Who in America and other similar publications. He studied at Cornell University, the University of Denver, and the University of Arizona. During World War II, he served in the technical training headquarters of the U.S. Army Air Corps. His father is the probation officer for Yavapai County, Arizona. His greatest work in anthropology has been in his intimate studies of American Indians. An interesting sidelight on his energetic and forthright nature was his insistence on practically living with the Indian tribes which he was studying. He not only arranged to have himself adopted as the son of an Indian chief, but he studied and practiced some of the tribe's ceremonial Indian dances so successfully that he actually won several coveted prizes in intertribal competitions with his Indian brothers. All of this may seem a long way from flying saucers, but as a matter of fact, it was his study of Indian legends which A.C. Tuali led to his interest in, and remarkable experiences with, spaceships and spacer visitors. All this we had learned from friends before the lecture. Also, we read his first book, The Sources Speak, which was co-authored by his friend Alfred C. Bailey. But nothing we had learned had prepared us for the three-pronged surprise we experienced when we finally met him. The first surprise was his exuberant youthfulness. No wonder his intimates call him Rick instead of Dr. George Williamson. Our second discovery was the extent of his own saucer experiences entirely independent of the Adamski affair. Finally, there was the depth and brilliance of his understanding of the cosmic implications of the saucer phenomena. Here was a sorcerer to whom the physical manifestations of saucers were not nearly as important as the great vista of cosmic life and progress which lay beyond them. His lecture amazed us in its scope and breadth of view. He told how his own study of American Indian legends and his wife's study of Mexican Indian legends brought out the fact that primitive tribes almost everywhere had essentially parallel legendary accounts of their people seeing rotating wheels or whirling wheels in the heavens, sometimes surrounded by a cloud or by fire. These would descend to the earth, and out would step a fair-haired young man or god from the skies. He found that almost all primitive people throughout the world seemed to have similar legends. Later, Dr. Williamson picked up and read a copy of Major Donald Kehoe's first saucer book, The Flying Saucers Are Real. There immediately flashed through his mind the extraordinary similarity between these modern sky phenomena and those of the Indian legends. His interest in the modern occurrences finally became so great that he and a group of friends discussed possible ways and means of trying to contact the sky visitors. They reasoned that if these beings had the intelligence and the technique for spaceflight, they certainly must have the technique for electronic and radio communications and the ability to monitor our radios and learn our languages. With characteristic directness, he and his wife and a group of friends lost no time in trying to contact these beings by any and every means at hand. They started out with simple experiments in various types of automatic writing, branched into coded radio telegraphy, tried out radio, and eventually some of the group reached direct telepathic communication. Between August 2nd and November 1st, a three-month period in 1952 when spaceships seemed to be especially prevalent over the North American continent, they achieved a truly remarkable series of contacts, mostly by radio telegraphy using the International Morse code and 350 to 450 kilocycles. During this period they were able to contact space beings of a high order from many regions in space, to ask them innumerable direct questions, and to receive many informative answers. A few of the highlights of these high-level contacts may be of interest to our readers. The code from outer space came through in a very strong and powerful manner, and the transmission was so fast that at times it was quite difficult to record all of it. On the other hand, the spelling of the English words was often a bit crude and on the phonetic side, as if the visitors were not too well versed in our language. The space beings referred to their spaceships as bells. Crystal bells. They stated that the spaceships burned no fuel but glided on magnetic lines of force and operated in a resonating electromagnetic field like a planetary body. The space beings discussed the atomic bomb, the critical condition of our Earth and its inhabitants, and their effort to help us into a new age which had commenced for our planet. This point interested us especially, because gradually in our pilgrimage we were destined to learn that similar statements regarding our Earth entering a very critical period were to be a part of practically every contact between Earthmen and space beings. One member of the group asked the visitors why they did not contact well-known scientists instead of amateurs like themselves. The reply was that they had done so, but that many in high positions would not listen. They also implied that they had contacted various Earth governments, including the Russians. Mrs. Williamson was particularly interested in certain medical and curative practices, and a question of the following import was asked: "You have such tremendous developments in spaceships, etc. Have you likewise advanced in medical science?" The answer came back as an abrupt no. Dr. Williamson told us that they were so amazed at this reply that he vigorously protested that such an answer did not seem reasonable. How could it be that they had the technique of spaceships but had not advanced in medical science? The reply in substance was simple: no disease, no medical science. On one occasion a friend saw what appeared to be a spaceship over the antenna of their radio shack. On another occasion a beam of white light was thrown from the sky down into the radio shack and the adjacent house while radio contact was in progress. Over this beam the spacer visitors apparently were able to discern everything that was going on among the group both mentally and physically. They even took part in diagnosing the illness of an elderly man in the house. This incident led to a message which Dr. Williamson regards as one of the most significant among all the messages they have received. It was as follows: "Never fear the aged. They can help again when they are brought to life." Dr. Williamson has his own interpretation of this message, but he wisely insists that all individuals must make their own interpretations. He has also become concerned that we prepare ourselves for the fact that man in outer space does not necessarily always manifest in precisely the same human configuration as we do. Dr. Williamson also gave us this gem: "From our research, I have learned that man is not man because he has two legs, two arms, and two eyes placed in a certain position in his head, or because he is supposed to have come up from the anthropoid ape. Man is man because he is a spiritual being. He exists throughout the universe, and as a race, man is an inhabitant of space and takes on certain physical manifestations or vehicles on certain planets to learn certain lessons and have certain pleasure-pain experiences. We can liken our Earth very simply to a school. The space people tell us we are not going to get off this planet until we make the grade and learn the lessons which this Earth has to teach us." This small saucer group tried to arrange a saucer landing and a physical meeting with their spacer friends, which almost succeeded. They were frustrated, however, by a series of adverse events. Later, Four of the group were members of the Adamski expedition when physical contact was made with a space being near Desert Center, California. In fact, Dr. Williamson made the plaster casts of the footprints of the man from outer space, as already stated. We talked to him at great length regarding this event. 28, and he endorses the factual account given in the Leslie Adamski writings. We were very much impressed with his lecture. It seemed to us to present an outstanding balance between his own personal experiences, his unselfish and honest recognition of the value of the experiences of others, and his remarkable grasp of the nature of the space people and their necessary but beneficent purpose in our skies at this time. Here was a little group of private researchers who were extraordinarily successful in achieving O.S.C. outer space communication, and who were learning something of the incredible powers, both physical and mental, of the beings in outer space. Dr. Williamson has visited at our home, and we have been with him on numerous occasions. Months later, in May of 1955, after our return from Mexico, we drove to his home in Prescott, Arizona, to visit him. There we met his charming wife and young son. In his hometown we found Rick to be a true Westerner, cowboy boots, plaid shirt, really the outdoor type. We found him putting the finishing touches on a new book entitled Other Tongues, Other Flesh. His group has abandoned radio telegraphy and radio as a means of contacting the space of visitors in favor of infrared and ultraviolet light beams. He and various associates are now diligently developing these preferred methods, and they have already experienced some unpublished successes. The Williamsons certainly represent New Age young people, and we wish them well in their latest efforts at contacting advanced beings in other dimensions of life. Chapter 5. Desmond Leslie comes to Detroit. In October of 1954, the Detroit saucer enthusiasts had the opportunity of meeting Desmond Leslie, co-author of Flying Saucers Have Landed. He had crossed the ocean from the British Isles a few months previously to do saucer research in the U.S.A. and, believe it or not, to meet his co-author George Adamski, for the first time. It is amazing how these two individuals, living so far apart in miles and so fundamentally different in personality, education and background, ever got together without personally meeting, and nevertheless collaborated on their book. We at least feel it speaks pretty well for those unseen forces of nature that somehow bring such things about. Mr. Leslie has brought forth a noteworthy historical research on spaceships in antiquity. He delved clear back to Sanskrit records some 5,000 years old. As he told us in Detroit, the farther back I went, the better became the record of spaceships. Many of the early reports came from astronomers. We feel it is he, probably more than anyone else, who has aroused the present-day world to the startling fact that spaceships in the atmosphere of Earth are really not new phenomena. His historical research and Adamski's modern contact with the spaceman were separate things that needed each other, and somehow they just naturally came together in their book. As a result, the book soon became one of the most widely read saucer books in the world. Mr. Leslie is a fine, tall, cultured young Irishman, who is a second cousin to Winston Churchill, was a Spitfire pilot in World War II, and lives part of the time in an old Irish castle. He lends an air of respectability to the saucer fraternity which is certainly an asset to so new a branch of human knowledge. He told us that he was the author of several novels, and that his publisher had suggested he write a fiction story on flying saucers. He then started upon his historical research and soon informed his publisher that what he had found was not fiction. We discovered he has a grand sense of humor and enjoys both give and take. His lectures sparkle with pungent wit and humor. Our group was exceedingly interested in learning that some members of the British nobility were intensely interested in saucers and were well versed in the subject. He also spoke of Lord Dowding, British Air Chief Marshal during the Battle of Britain, and his interest in saucers. Parenthetically, for those not familiar with some of the public statements regarding saucers made by Lord Dowding, we give the following quotation: I am convinced that these objects do exist and that they are not manufactured by any nation on Earth. I can therefore see no alternative but to accept the theory that they come from some extraterrestrial source. Desmond Leslie gave a remarkable radio interview in Detroit. After the success of the Adamski radio interview, sorcerers were now more welcome on radio broadcasts, and we made an effort to tape record these events. One of our favorite tape recordings is still that of Mr. Leslie's interview, for it was filled with lively, informative and humorous interchanges between him and Russ Mulholland, who again officiated. Later Mr. Leslie lectured in the large auditorium of the Detroit Institute of Arts. A capacity audience of over 1,200 attended, and between 200 and 300 disappointed people had to be turned away because of lack of room. This will give some idea of the interest that exists in flying saucers in Detroit. Mr. Leslie drew a hearty laugh when he told of his encounters with astronomers. It seems that this saucer busyness was not exactly in accord with certain British traditions, particularly in the field of astronomy. This fact brought Mr. Leslie into public and rather amusing controversy with no less an authority on astronomy than the Right Honourable British Astronomer Royal himself. As we understand it, the Astronomer Royal allowed that it was politic to bury the flying saucers once and for all, and thus get rid of such nonsense forever. Mr. Leslie allowed that he had a better idea, namely, to bury the Astronomer Royal while the sparks were flying from this contact between the old and the new in merry old England. The British Air Minute's history dubbed Mr. Leslie the Sorcerer Royal. The term sorcerer so amused and intrigued us that we purloined it for our pilgrimage. We hope our British cousins will not mind. A high point of audience interest came when this visitor to our shores touched upon the strange doings that went on at Muroc Air Base, California, in the summer of 1954. It seems that very suddenly soldiers outside the base, even those returning from leave, were directed away and told to get lost, while those inside the base were kept inside. There was plenty of high brass activity at the time and persistent rumors that a remote controlled saucer had landed voluntarily and was in hangar number 27. Many saucer fans were already familiar more or less with these rumors. Nevertheless, it was fascinating saucer smoke to many, and who knows but that sometime the government of the people, for the people, and by the people may haul out top secret file No. H. 27 and condescend to tell the governed a little more about the fire that caused the smoke, a little peek into what gives in the secret closets of our modern bureaucracy. Or was this all just some of our own efforts to reproduce a saucer? Who knows? Another high spot in the lecture was Mr. Leslie's reference to the presence of flying saucers in the blasts of atomic bombs, as could be seen in certain photographs taken of the explosions. It is presumed that these were remote-controlled saucers. During the question and answer period, one talkative lady took up so much time that Mr. Leslie courteously but firmly suggested that she confine herself to questions rather than try to make another saucer lecture. This drew such an amen sigh of approval from the audience that maybe we need more British lecturers over here. Then a brash young man wanted to know what Sir Winston Churchill thought about saucers. It took a bit of genteel maneuvering to get around that one, but you can always count on the Irish. A year later we saw the Sorcerer Royal again when he had returned to the U.S.A. a second time and was lecturing in Columbus, Ohio, on October 26, 1955. In this case, interest in his lecture was heightened by the fact that a publicized blast from our Air Force a few days previously had positively denied the existence of flying saucers, and called attention to its own development of saucer-like jet aircraft. This gave Mr. Leslie something of an uphill effort, but he handled it beautifully and directed much of his lecture to basic sightings. He brought out some excellent new sightings in England and one contact near London. In this instance it seems that a flying saucer knocked an English gardener off his bicycle. We do not wish to be facetious, but with the Air Force's denial of flying saucers we began to wonder if this is not the very type of contact that our military brass badly needs, to be hit on the head with a flying saucer. Or would they still deny the saucers? He also brought out the point that if he had talked about television 100 years ago, he probably would have been put in a straitjacket. 200 years ago, he would have been burned at the stake for witchcraft. We enjoyed the Sorcerer Royal very much and feel that he is among those chosen to bring the new age message to doubting humanity. Cheerio. May our paths cross again. Chapter 6. We head for OLD Mexico.